Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. It is a beautiful morning, folks. Steve Williamson here. Sitting across from me is
Mike Cosentino, the beloved co-host. I want to go back to that. I kind of miss that. We'll have to discuss that.
We have two guests in the studio today, don't we, Mike?
And we do.
We're talking about a concept of justice that many people are not familiar with called restorative justice. But let's introduce our guests.
Yeah. We have Warren Sanford and Elizabeth Yancey. Elizabeth's been on the show before, back on another sort of a shop show, Democrats at the Red Rock show. But let's let them introduce themselves, and if nothing else, so we can hear their voices. Women first, in this case, Elizabeth. Elizabeth Yancey, tell us a little bit about yourself. You live here?
Yes.
All right, then.
I do live in Sedona. Happily, very happily.
Happily in Sedona.
Every morning when I wake up and look at the mountains, I just, wow. Yes. I've been here 13 years. I came up from the Valley where I was a court commissioner and judge pro tem for 14 years in the Maricopa County Superior Court. Prior to that, I practiced law in Phoenix and Tucson. And since I've been in Sedona, I practiced law for about a year or so and became very involved with the Democrats of the Red Rocks. That was just starting at that time.
Right.
And had a wonderful learning experience and found out that there are just lots of Democrats in the Sedona area, which was a surprise, actually, from what I had been hearing about.
You hear that a lot, yeah.
And after being involved with Democrats of the Red Rocks and helping get Janet Napolitano elected, I accepted an appointment to the magistrate court here in Sedona and served there for 5 years and left there 3 years ago and became a mediator and a facilitator for restorative justice, for the Verde Valley Restorative Justice Program that is still going on in Sedona and in the Verde Valley. In fact, we just recently expanded.
We like to say if you left court in handcuffs, it was Elizabeth that had a role to play in that. And Warren?
Sure, I'm Warren Sanford, and I'm a third-generation Flagstaff resident. My grandfather came to Arizona.
You're the one.
I am. One of the few.
About it.
My grandfather came to Flagstaff pre-statehood and was a school teacher with the Flagstaff Public Schools into the 1960s. And so as a third-generation Flagstaff resident, my grandparents and my parents both instilled a devotion to public service and stewardship for our community. And my judicial appointment was in 2001 to the Flagstaff and Williams Courts. I've served as magistrate and justice of the peace pro tem since that time. And my passion during graduate school was with restorative justice, and that was of course, the subject of our discussion earlier today.
Yeah.
And
It should be mentioned that both these guys just came from the old Sedona Bar and Grill, where they did a great presentation to the morning breakfast group over there. And I have to say that your speech or your subject was so inspiring. You had instant volunteers and people that jumped up and wanted to be involved in this. And we don't see that too often. We have monthly presentations there, so
tell us about what is restorative justice, because I think that most people out there really have never heard the term. And then I think particularly Elizabeth, tell us a little bit about what it is theoretically, Warren, and Elizabeth, and maybe can expand on what it's like practically when you practice restorative justice. You're both experienced people in the law.
Sure. Well, restorative justice as compared to perhaps the more commonly known style of justice in the United States, we call retributive justice, is a punitive-based model that focuses primarily with two parties, the prosecuting agency, which represents the government, and the offender. And so that approach to justice often leaves out the victim and the community as a whole in a more full circle, holistic response to crime and its aftermath. And so restorative justice is a process whereby all parties relating to a crime with a stake in a particular offense come together to resolve collectively how to deal with the aftermath of the offense and certainly its implications for the future.
I think it's kind of interesting, but we're talking about all parties. As we understand restorative justice, as we, you know, we understand the term, we think of the victim and the perpetrator, the harm and the harmer, at least, one source called it. But there's also the third aspect, and that's a community aspect. And when you talk about all people involved in restorative justice, you know, all the stakeholders, I guess you want to.
Well, that's right. And the community as a whole is also harmed by crime because of its loss of confidence in whether it's law enforcement or whether it's in its own understanding of a sense of justice. That has been harmed as well when there has been crime. And particularly the victim and not least the offender as part of that community deserve to be a part of the healing process that involves the community that they belong to so that completes the circle of all the parties with a stake in wanting to address the issues and wanting to move beyond the issues and to restore a sense of confidence and safety in a livable community.
Sure. What does restore mean in this case? Restore means to make right.
Sure. And reparation to the victim as well. And restoring the confidence, restoring and repairing the harm done, making reparation, whether it's restitution to the victim or whether it's community restitution to the greater community. And it's important that the community be part of that healing process, to be part of being receptive to the incident, certainly, but also being invested in how to bring closure to the issue and to bring the parties that were harmed by crime, particularly the victim, and again, not least the offender, back into a productive involvement with the community.
Elizabeth, why don't you give us one example, and then we'll talk more about the idea of restorative. One example from your work, and I know you've done extensive work in this area, one example of how it works in practice, what we're talking about when we talk about restorative justice in practice.
This applies generally to most of the cases that we receive. We get the cases from the Yavapai County Juvenile Probation Department, and they have criteria that they use to determine which juveniles who have offended get to participate in restorative justice. Usually, one of the things that they consider in deciding whether the young person gets referred to restorative justice is their history of violence, their prior history of breaking the law or disrupting school and that sort of thing. Although there are no ironclad guidelines, the way I understand it. When we receive the referral, we also get a copy of the police report for us to review according to what the officer, either through investigation or interviews, has determined is the basis of the charge against the juvenile. After we receive that paperwork, we contact the juvenile's family and make arrangements to meet with. Usually it's a boy.
So the juvenile throws a brick through a car window and
yes.
It gets caught.
Yes.
And then this process begins.
After the police officer writes a citation or a referral form to juvenile probation, this is the very beginning of the process. That's correct. I was thinking back, the most recent cases that I've been dealing with are young people who are using drugs or alcohol. Most recently, I have been involved with a case where a group of three young men were smoking marijuana and using marijuana in one of our local parks, and they went through that process, and we got their information and contacted their families. They agreed to participate in our program, and we met in a large circle, including all three of the boys, their families, their mothers, father, and other extended family members. The officer who did the arrest investigation was not able to be there, although usually that is the case. We invite the officers always to participate. And since the victim was the broader community, the juveniles and their families, there was no third party, if you will, identified victim in this case, because the violation is a violation of state law. In other words, they're prohibited from using marijuana by state law. And so There's no identified victim, as there would have been, for example, had this been a shoplift or a car vandalization or an assault case. So in this particular case, because it was a drug and alcohol or drug case, we met in a circle. Everyone in the circle, beginning with the three boys, discussed what happened, what they did. Each of them was asked to tell how this situation that gave rise to the arrest arose, and they explained the circumstances. They all agreed on who had the marijuana and who distributed it and whose idea it was and so forth. And after they finished that, then we asked the parents how they were impacted by the arrest and by the knowledge that their sons had been using marijuana. And not one of the parents, I'm sorry, two of the parents were completely shocked when they heard this. One had known that her son had been using drugs for quite a number of years and had known what to do to deal with it, had tried a number of things that were unsuccessful. After we heard from the parents, that involved a lot of sadness on their part because they were disappointed in their sons. They thought that they had raised their sons to know better than to break the law or to use drugs. And so they were very sad. There was just a lot of disappointment, grief, some anger that came out in that part of the circle. Let me back up for a moment and give a little bit of context about this particular circle and all of them that restorative justice uses here. The circle is a place where people feel comfortable talking about things that are embarrassing, upsetting, that they may be angry about, they may be hurt about, because we, a part of our principles on which we operate is to treat everyone involved with respect, the same respect we would like to receive from anyone else. So we make a point of letting people know that they're not bad, the parents are not bad parents, the kids are not bad kids, they made certain decisions. And this decision on this particular day that resulted in this arrest was not a good decision. It doesn't say anything about who the child is. We're not labeling, and that's part of the ground rules that make a meeting or a circle a place where people feel comfortable talking about these sensitive subjects. Another of our ground rules is that there is no blaming or shaming or judging. There's no going out into the community and talking about what people said they did. It's all confidential within that circle, unless, of course, what is reported to us is that someone is actively engaged in abusing a child or an adult or plans on doing something like that or harming someone else. Then, of course, we have to report that to the authorities. But outside of that situation, nothing is to be repeated that is said in that circle. Also, we want the young people to know that they are not going to be what they call being yelled at. They're not going to be criticized or demeaned in any way by anyone there because we are honoring their humanity. We're not treating them as if they are a convicted drug user, if you will. That there's a very different context when you're using those words of blame and shame as compared to using the words that this person made a mistake, because we all know that we've all made mistakes, and that's how we want this young person, in this case, these three boys, to see the choice that they made. They made a wrong choice, and what we try to do in that circle is get to how did that come about? What were their expectations? So that's how that part of the circle works. And in this particular case, Elizabeth, that's what happened.
Do you have techniques? I mean, the circle sounds wonderful and it sounds effective, but do you have, you're going to have angry parents and you're going to have angry offenders. And they're going to, and they may, so is there some preparation before you get into the circle, some training or some, something before, because I can see some angry people acting out in a situation like that.
Especially if there's an actual victim to the crime rather than it being a victimless crime, and what we call a victimless crime. What happens, Elizabeth, now let me ask the kind of dark side of this, what happens if they don't agree to participate in restorative justice?
Then they have the option of going through whatever processes probation has available to them and whatever programs probation has available to them. They also have the option of pleading not guilty and going through the court process, having a trial, having an attorney, and requiring the state's attorney to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, as they are required to do in every criminal case, that this juvenile has in fact violated the law. We only receive young people for our program from probation who have admitted that they violated and who've already said they don't want to go to court. They don't want to go through that process.
On that, I want to go back to Warren here and ask about, you know, we'd be remiss if we don't clarify the difference between restorative justice and retribution, retributive justice. Like I say, as an English teacher, I appreciate the parallel structure using the same form of the term, but traditional courts deal with retribution. You committed a crime, the state's going to get back at you, we're going to do whatever. One person's justice is another person's revenge, which is a conversation probably we can do all day. But clarify for us the difference between restorative justice. Actually, we kind of got a good idea of what that is now. But go back to what regular justice is, non-restorative justice, Warren.
Sure. And I think it's important to know that the distinction between retributive justice and restorative justice is not an all or nothing proposition. There can be components of each, and certainly the constitutional rights that are preserved either in engaging in restorative justice or those who aren't interested in participating in restorative justice are still able to exercise their rights for a trial, of course, to a judge or to a jury, but also through a plea bargaining process, defendants are eligible for diversions or deferred prosecution, which can, upon successful completion of program requirements, end up with a dismissal of the charges. So, again, not an all or nothing proposition. Retributive justice comes from the Code of Hammurabi, an eye for an eye. It's punitive. It is retaliatory based justice, and it specifically involves the state as the charging party and the offender as the determination of legal guilt and subsequent punishment.
Okay, then what we're used to as far as the justice system goes, the whole concept of restorative justice now. It seems that we're having a great deal of success, Elizabeth. I heard statistics about, and then we can start with recidivism and work our way back. Those people that have gone to jail once and are going back, the national average was 40%. The Arizona average was 47%. And your average was incredibly better than that. Tell us about your success of restorative justice when it comes to that.
Our success rate is we have fewer than 14% of the young people who come through our program and successfully complete it who go on to commit another offense.
No, I have to admit, the deck is a little bit stacked. You only get first offenders. And that's something else I want to ask you about is, I understand the reason for only first offenders, I guess, but it seems like even second and third offenders for the kinds of crimes which are nonviolent, maybe drug, maybe shoplifting, these kinds of crimes that could lead to others, but it seems like it's really limiting to only limited, in my opinion, to just first offenders for these. In other words, it shouldn't be the number of offenses where that would be the determination of who gets restorative justice, but the severity of the crime.
And right now you're only working with juveniles, right? You're not
correct.
Working with
and
adults.
Let me just try to clarify something here. You're correct. The deck is stacked in our favor in some regard because most of these young people have not been involved with charges. They've not been charged with breaking the law in the past, most of them. We do get some who are second and third, they're rare. This particular program is still in its formative years. Uh-huh. We do not have the resources, either financially or with facilitators who are trained, to handle more cases. And the Juvenile Probation Department of Yavapai County has worked very closely with us from the beginning, and we would not be here if it were not for their support.
We do want to do a little homage to Scott Mabry.
Absolutely.
He was the resource officer at Mingus Union High School when I was there, and then had some, at the beginning of his career, and had some wonderful impact on young people there. And it's it's great to hear that he's still doing having that sort of impact.
And even more, he is, and his staff are some of the most dedicated, hardworking, conscientious, and caring human beings I have ever encountered, I must say. And I've been in, as I said, I've been in the legal system for, it seems like, hundreds of years, but I don't think it's quite that long. So I truly appreciate all the effort that the probation officers and the administration, especially Scott, have invested in helping our program to grow. They could have been giving us every young person that came through their doors if they had chosen to do that. And they knew we didn't have the ability to respond. And they have worked with us to create this set of criteria, perhaps borders, for what we will be able to deal with and effectively manage, effectively provide the service that we provide for a given number of people. And I just cannot say enough good about the Juvenile Probation Department in Yavapai County. I also volunteered for them for a while, and I've also been through their Juvenile Court Institute, which is a rigorous and very valuable program as well. All of their volunteers have to complete that. So they are proactive in looking at ways to help young people in our community. And they recognize, as I believe I mentioned a moment ago, they recognize that unless we treat young people with respect, respecting their own humanity as much as our own, that the response is not going to be positive. It's not going to take that young person to the next step in their life. It's going to hold them back. Just our attitude toward them has a huge impact on their success, both in our restorative justice program and in probation. And they recognize that, and they are incorporating more and more programs and developing more and more programs to help their probation officers work most effectively with the juveniles that come through their doors. And they're adding more and more restorative aspects to it as time goes on.
That's great. I think it's so important for a community like this to hear that, because I think we base some of our opinions on juvenile probation, what we see on television, what we hear about other communities, and that we have such a positive thing going on in this area in Yavapai County, and Sedona. Is really good to have. I mean, the only time we hear about it, we don't hear about when it's doing well and everything's working unless we do something like this. We hear about it when somebody screws up or something isn't going so
right,
well.
Exactly.
Warren?
Well, sure. And in regards to the human condition that Elizabeth had mentioned, attention is given not only to the outcome when we work through restorative justice processes, but also to a process that respects the feelings and the humanity of both the victim and the offender. The process seeks to recognize not only whether a crime has occurred, but also why offenders have violated the law and what are the social and cultural aspects that are behind some of the decisions. I think it's safe to say that all of us have at one point or another made decisions that we've, given the circumstances we were faced with at the time, have come to regret.
Still, daily.
Absolutely. and so one has to consider principles, the principles you live by, are your principles based on comfort and convenience or on conviction? And I think the distinction there is that it's far easier to talk about your principles than to truly live up to them. And that's part of the approach that we take with restorative justice, is making that distinction and a recognition that, sure, our principles are challenged many times a day, but it's how we respond to those challenges that will ultimately define our character. And so the human aspect and the respect that is shown to the offenders and to the victim, and the involvement of all the parties, is where I think the real benefit comes in a restorative, reparative process.
Well, what about the charge, Warren, Elizabeth, that you're coddling offenders? Now, in the case of some kids smoking marijuana, there's no real victim to that. But somebody throws a brick through a car window, you know, there's a victim, the people who own the car. Are you coddling the people who maybe there's two of them threw a brick through the car? Are you coddling the people who did the damage to somebody's car, or what are you doing with this?
I'd like to answer that question. First of all, most young people don't consider the consequences of their actions, because that part of the brain that deals with executive functioning is just beginning to develop. Having said that, what happens in a restorative circle is that those two young people who threw the bricks in the car window will be sitting in a room with the people who own the car, looking at them in the face while they tell what they did to damage the car. That's part of the process. They have to share what they did to break the law, to cause the harm. And when they're done, the people who own the car get to ask them any questions that they want to about the choices that they made, the decisions that they made to go ahead and pick this particular car and so forth, so that the victims have the opportunity to hear. Often, most victims, if you talk to them after a court case, for example, they'll say, I just wanted to know, why me? Why did we get picked to be mugged? Why did we get picked to be pushed down on the sidewalk or have our car broken into? And that's usually the first question that the victims ask. And in this case, the people who committed the offenses are sitting across from them and must answer that question. And part of the ground rules is that you must tell the truth. If you're not going to tell the truth, we'll call the circle off and everybody gets to go home, because we're not going to waste our time listening to, quote, stories from people about what happened. If they're going to take responsibility for their actions, which they must do in order to participate in our program, they have to tell the truth about it. Then they have to listen to how the victim was impacted by what they decided to do. And very often, that is the first time that these young people will have had to face in person, right there, in their face, in a manner of speaking, the consequences of a decision that they made. Unfortunately, many, many young people that we see have had parents who have covered for them throughout their lives, and so they've never really had to face a difficult situation in which they are being held accountable by an entire group, a room full of people, some of whom they've never met before, perhaps a facilitator, the arresting officer, the family members of the victims, all of whom will be present in that room. So going through that process is not the same thing that would happen if that young person had pled not guilty and went to a trial. Victims' rights are protected in the state of Arizona under the Constitution, as you all probably are quite aware. And the victims have to be notified in court of all court proceedings, of specific events in the prosecution process. They must be notified by law. That doesn't mean they ever get the chance to sit down with the defendant and say, why me? Why did you pick our car? Did we ever do something to you? Was it something we said? This is, according to the information that I've been reading about victims of crime and their recovery from being victimized. Of course, much depends on the severity and the type of a violation. But most people cannot begin a healing process, an ability to deal with that gnawing, visceral harm that was done to them when their home was broken into or their car was damaged. They don't begin to heal until they have the ability to get answers to these kinds of questions.
So it's not just, you know, they break in, they steal your television set, and they have to pay for a new television set for you if they broke it. It's a much larger impact that you're trying to get. I mean, that's a very different process,
very
don't
different,
you think,
yeah.
Mike? Oh, without sitting a doubt. Right across from the person that you victimized.
That's anything but coddling. Ask any young person, ask any person for that matter, facing the person that you've harmed. In that situation is the opposite of coddling. I mean, the whole retribution form of justice is for many ways easier to take. You know, okay, you did this. You're going to do whatever you're going to do. You're going to serve your sentence and go on. Is easier than facing the people that you've hurt. I believe. And that's the whole thing. That's the basis for this whole program, I would imagine.
Well, excuse me, Warren, I just want to add one other thing, because people don't understand, and people do think this is not effective because it is, we're being too soft on people who commit crimes. The other part of the process that I did not mention is that the victim gets to tell this young person what they need in order to have the harm repaired. So the first thing in the bricks through the car windshield would be probably replace my windshield with an equal quality one, clean and have the inside of the car cleaned and detailed so that it's not dangerous for us, my family members, to get in there. Also, I want a written apology letter, and I want you to send me your grades. I think that that's a good indication of how well you're doing in life, is how well you're doing in school. I want to know what grade you're making for the next year, and I want to have them within a week of your being, of your family receiving them. And if you're not keeping up a B or C average, whatever they say, I want to know how you're being in the community and if you are a danger to me and my family or anyone else. And that's what they, sometimes we get these kinds of requests. And that we honor those requests, so we go back and forth, and people talk about, is this something that's doable by this young person? Of course, that would be doable.
Sure.
Is it measurable? That's another thing that we have as part of the requirements for the tasks or jobs that the young offender must do in order to be restored, in order to repair the harm that they created, and to be able to say, I made amends, I made appropriate amends, and now I am legitimately entitled to be a contributing citizen of my community again. That's the purpose of restorative justice.
Seems like you're saying both sides get it. You know, both the victims and the offenders get restorative justice. They understand it, and they pretend that. But if the circle goes well, then the kinds of things that you're talking about, if they're asking for this, these kinds of things, then they understand what this is all about.
Yes, they do. We make every effort to ensure that people do understand exactly what is the process and what is the likely outcome or what is the hope for outcome. And if the young people don't do those things, then their case goes back to probation, and then probation has to decide whether or not they're going to put them into other programs, mm-hmm. or if they're just going to send them to the judge and let the judge decide if they're going to plead guilty, which they've already pled guilty, so to speak, not formally, but they have admitted responsibility, if they're going to plead guilty formally, and what sentence they're going to receive. And that will be on their record. If they successfully complete our program, then what happens is that the charge is essentially dismissed. It's not removed, but it's dismissed after they successfully complete our program, if they are not arrested again between the time that they came into our program.
So it wouldn't interfere with getting a job then as much, or
correct.
Joining the army,
exactly.
or whatever the young person wants to do.
And that's what we're hoping
because
for.
Because it's there, but it's dismissed. It's not a conviction.
Correct.
I think another distinction and difference that's important to illustrate is between restorative and retributive justice. Our current policies and practices of criminal justice focus almost entirely on the offender as lawbreaker, and it filters out virtually all aspects of crime except questions of legal guilt and punishment. And so after a verdict is rendered and an offender is sentenced to jail, then you have the courtroom working groups outside high-fiving everybody, hey, justice has been served. And in the meantime, you have victims and you have the community as a whole that is still reeling from the outcome of the crime and has no idea what that means in implications for the future. When you think about restorative justice and you think about the parties that come to the table and you begin to see where an offender is taking responsibility for his or her actions, and then you start to see the victim beginning to have faith in the process and the outcome and beginning to truly believe that the offender is making amends, is working toward reparations, you see the stress levels starting to fall off, and you see that there is much less likelihood of a victim wanting to be retaliatory toward an offender. And then the whole process just takes a complete turn toward a more healing and holistic approach. And it's really gratifying when you see the whole change of heart and the whole change of attitude toward what happened, because there is faith and there is a hope and an expectation that a wrong has been righted.
That's
I was thinking about a home, somebody breaking into your home. There's a feeling of violation even beyond just losing your TV set or whatever's taken. There's a sense that your space has been, and it seems to me this gives some way to address that that's kind of beyond the law, because if you take it in the retributive system, you've stolen a $500 TV set. That's classified as a certain kind of way, but it doesn't take into account the psychological damage, and also say your house is broken in, then people in your neighborhood hear your house is broken in. It sets off a kind of a wave, at least a small wave of fear and concern that goes beyond our legal system to be able to address directly, right?
Yeah, I remember certainly hearing about it from a variety of communities, especially maybe some of the more planned communities, that these things go around the neighborhood really fast. You know, my parents spent years in Florida, and it was I don't know, it seemed like it's more common there. I haven't spent enough time in the retirement communities of Arizona, but their crime statistics and perpetrators were well known. If it happened at 9 o'clock in the morning, by noon it was lunch conversation all over whatever community it happened to be. And very often those things were exaggerated or carried to excessive.
The other thing is that I struck me personally was the irrationality of crime that I saw in New York. And the woman who lived upstairs from us said, "My door's open." So I had Lumina baseball bat, and I went up with trepidation up the stairs, feeling that if I see the birds, I'm going to run down the flight of stairs, baseball bat or
to
not.
The rescue.
Anyway, the police are on their way. And so we go up, and she wants to see it. She teaches at John Jay, which is the criminal justice college in New York. Whoever stole her money, he didn't take her black and white TV or whatever it was, or whatever. Her TV was too small and worthless for him to carry down the stairs, right? He took, $12-$13 worth of change that had been sitting around and money. He had lowered himself from the roof onto a narrow windowsill that was two feet wide. And then climbed in through her window. And I thought, my God, this guy has risked his life and limb for pocket change. And I mean, wouldn't it be better if you could catch this guy and get him to do something useful with his, I mean, he should be a mountain climber or join a SWAT team or something. He shouldn't be luring himself in particularly in our neighborhood in New York and grabbing pocket change. But it made me afraid climbing those stairs, and it made the people who live down below us afraid, and it made everybody feel vulnerable if the guy can lower himself down and get in there, why not in my apartment? And it set off a lot of things beyond which the law really doesn't normally talk about. The law, you catch the guy, you put him in jail or whatever it is. But he's just going to get out of jail, right, folks? I mean, he's just going to get out of jail, and what does he know how to do? I mean, if he's willing to do that for a few bucks.
Getting back to, I want to get back to restorative justice in a minute, but I also want to mention a couple of groups that give us some help in order to bring Democratic perspective to on the air. And Democrats of the Red Rocks throw a few bucks our way. Democrats of the Verde Valley do also. And we do have one announcement. We do. They are planning an Affordable Health Care Act explained event. The speakers at that event on November 10th at the St. Andrew's Church in Sedona, in West Sedona, November 10th, 2 p.m., St. Andrew's Church, an event titled Your Life, Your Health, Your Coverage. Let's see, we have Dr. Cynthia Beckett, Director of Evidence-Based Practice Research from the Flagstaff Medical Center. We have Larry Morrison, the Faculty Associate from the University College at NAU. We have Dr. Samuel Buttman, Chief of Staff of the Verde Valley Medical Center. I believe he's a cardiologist. I know
he's definitely a cardiologist. Yeah,
exactly.
Because he's my cardiologist.
There you go. I knew there'd be some personal testimonies. And we have Jim Ledbetter, who's the director of Northern Arizona Healthcare and the Verde Valley Medical Center, who's also been on our program several times, actually. And we look forward to having them. So they are. We might try to get them together for a show, but I don't know if that's going to happen. But anyway, they will be at the St. Andrew's Church here in West Sedona on November 10th, answering questions about the ACA, the Affordable Health Care Act.
We're talking this morning with Warren Sanford and Elizabeth Yancey. Both have been extensively involved in the justice system. Both have served as magistrates or justices of peace and have a lot of practical experience in the law. And we're talking this morning about restorative justice it's kind of, for many people, a very new idea, right?
Yeah, it is. I think it isn't. I think it's been tried before, maybe with varying degrees of success, but it seems like we got it going on here. But Elizabeth, you, during your presentation, you talked about the circles, and you gave us some nice details about the circles, and I feel like we did get one example from you, but we'd love to hear if you can conjure up any more of those, of how it works. I think we have at least a good idea of victim, offender, how does a community come in, and are there stakeholders from the community in some of these circles? And who would they be?
Yes, there are often community members, and they can be people who have begun to be trained as facilitators. And our facilitators, by the way, are from every walk of life. We have many teachers, artists, medical personnel. We have several law enforcement officers, current police officers. So those are the people who would be there representing the community.
Tell me about artists for real quickly. Why artists?
I don't know.
Oh. Oh, I see. You're just talking about different kinds of people that would be there.
Right. People who are being trained to be facilitators come from all walks of life, even lawyers.
No, okay. Yeah.
You will accept lawyers?
Yes, we do. We accept lawyers.
Very generous and kindly hearted.
But they changed the rules for me because I'm a lawyer, so they had changed.
I understand you did practice the law.
Where do these happen?
They happen in private conference rooms in a number of places around the Verde Valley. Verde Valley Guidance Center has been one of our partners for a long, long time, and they have been so generous in providing us with private space that's comfortable, that's well-lit, with a big well-lit parking lot. All of these considerations, of course, are made, and we very much appreciate their help. Also, they have a building in Sedona that we use from time to time, mm-hmm. behind the fire station. The Cottonwood Public Safety Building has been very generous in allowing us to use their facilities as well. They have several large conference rooms. So those are typically where our conferences are held because they accommodate a large number of people. Sometimes we have as many as 20 people in a circle.
How many cases a year, Elizabeth, do you folks do down here in Yavapai County?
On this side of Yavapai County in 2012, we had 70 cases that were referred to us. So far this year, I think we're in the neighborhood of 35 to 40 so far. I'm not sure.
Let's make sure we get some contact information in here before we run out of time. If people want to get involved, what do you got? How do we get a hold of you?
We have, they can call me, and my number is 928-821-3461 if they would like to volunteer or donate. We are getting ready to have a big fundraiser, our first annual Rummage for Rescue, thanks to the generosity of Old Sedona Bar and Grill, the owners. Uh-huh. We will be participating in that big rummage sale on November 2nd from 9 to 3. We invite everyone to participate in that.
Website?
Our website is under development. There's nothing on there. They can go to narj.org, but there's nothing there, unfortunately. We just became our own 501c3, so we're still in the process of putting those foundational parts into
Just to repeat,
place.
That's Elizabeth Yancey, 928-821-3461.
Correct. And they can also go email, which is, sorry. I don't
know
where my
cards are.
Don't
worry about it. And the name of the program, Elizabeth, is?
It is Northern. Oh, thank you. It's Northern Arizona Restorative Justice. The email, thank you to a wonderful person who had this with her, is narjustice@yahoo.com. They can also call our executive director, D. Zink. Her number is 602-369-1112. So again, the email is NAR, Northern Arizona Restorative, the word justice at yahoo.com.
And Warren, I understand you're running for office and have to declare you're running for office. We always appreciate when people stand for office. It's very important to run for office. And and tell folks what you're running for?
Well, thanks. I'm ready to bring it up a notch. I've been appointed as a Justice of the Peace pro temp since 2001, and so I'm running for the elected seat of Justice of the Peace in the Flagstaff precinct, the largest justice precinct in Coconino County.
All right. Thank you, Elizabeth Yancey. Thank you, Warren Sanford, for our program on restorative justice. If you're interested, please contact the number or give a call to the station. I'm sure they'll hook you up with Peace Patrol.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.